Blog Talk Radio.
At gmail.com. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, this is Doc Dean at, on the show called Getting It Done. And as always, you know, there's something that's always going to mess up. And the program that I had scheduled for today, my computer crashed. Can you believe that? I was going to talk about Jim Crowism, how it began. There is a saying historically, if you don't know your history, then you are subject to repeat it. Well, how much do we know about when Jim Crowism started in this country? In the country, it started early after Reconstruction in the South. That's in the 1870s. But in the North, it started too. Can you believe that? At one time, people gave the consideration that the North was free of all the biases and discrimination. However, it was available as well in the North. And, of course, it's still in vogue in all over the United States today. Better still, I call it a repeat of another form of slavery. It's when white people try and force a negative behavior over black people. Doesn't that sound like something very similar to slavery? Where the same connotation, where people were being forced to do work for nothing, were treated as animals, as chattel, I guess, both in the South and in the North. You know, people don't know that slavery was in the North as well as in the South. It concluded in the early 1800s. In 1837, New York outlawed slavery in the city of New York, or, you know, actually the whole state. And then most of the northern states followed thereafter. So when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed back in 1864, went into effect in 1865, the same connotation of slavery concluded all over, but it had already stopped in the North. So people don't know that Abraham Lincoln signed a piece of paper just to try to save the Union, not just to conclude slavery. So, but it's when white people had a strong hand over and controlling what black people said, what they did, where they went, how they ate, everything. Now, let's take that to another level. Black people during slavery lived in slave quarters away from what was called the big house, where the slave masters lived. Some worked in the slave master's house, and some worked in the fields. So consequently, they were separate. They lived in separate locations, except for those who may have cooked food or took care of babies or children, lived in the house. Separation. Most black slaves that came here from Africa were separated when they first came here. Later on, they were separated once again. And all over the United States, they were just separated. In the South, black people lived in shanties. They lived in broken down houses, broken down log cabins. For the floors that they had were made out of hard soil. When I went to visit my grandparents in South Carolina as a young kid, there was a house across the street from where my aunts lived, and in that house was where my parents grew up. It was a log cabin. It had no more than two rooms in it. a large room, which was probably the kitchen. A kitchen that had a stove in it, a wood cook stove, wood, and it had an area for wooden beds, no springs, just wooden beds, with a mattress on it. That was a historical house. It was there for years before the land was sold, and the city took over the facility. I don't know where that building is now, but it was there back in the 1950s, believe it or not, when I was real young. And I had an opportunity to see it. Now, this was right on the same street called Liberty Hill in Columbia, South Carolina. They were separate from where white people lived in Forest Hills. White people lived in another section. Black people lived in another section. My grandparents lived down on Liberty Hill, and my other grandparents lived on, that wasn't Campanella Circle, it was MacDuffie Street, which was like about two blocks up. Black people went to a separate church. Oh, if they went to a separate church, I think they did that during slavery. From what I read, they went to a separate church, although the minister sometimes was white and preached to them. Or if there was a black preacher, the black preacher was told by the slave masters what to do and what to say, what to read from the Bible, and how to interpret it. Everything that came out of that Bible was a way to get them to believe being segregated and segregated to what they were doing took place there. Also, when you go north, where I lived, you found the same connotation. Black people lived in a certain part of in Connecticut, a certain part of North Maine. And you found the same kind of thing where the white people lived on Columbia Boulevard or thereabouts, in the wealthiest part of Waterbury, or the moving from Waterbury to Watertown. Downtown area, where you found most of the black kids that went to one school, and that was Leavenworth or Croft High School. But you have a strong mixture of those particular students who were going to go to college, and most of those students were white. They had another school. It was built about the kind of industry that they had in Waterbury. And that particular industry was either clerical oriented, or it was working in different forms of shops. Waterbury was known as the brass center of the world. So they had all kinds of facilities, different kinds of shops. They were making all forms of metal and sheet rocks and things of that nature. So they had a high school, which was an industrial arts, for people who were going to go to work in those shops. Most of those were black students. The students who were going to go to college went to a cosmopolitan school, which was Crosby High School, and then Willoughby High School was a clerical school. So we had some black kids that went to the clerical school, but mostly black kids went to Leavenworth or Croft High School. Now, here is the bone of contention. How did it ever get to the point where black people lived a certain place in the north and white people lived in another location in the north? I remember when my father went to look for a house, and the people who he worked with went to help him get the house. He was told to stay outside while the people negotiated for the house. I knew my father understood why he was staying outside, because then this is in the north now. This is not in the south, because they did not want black people to live in that part of town. Is that very interesting? Because in the south, they had the same thing. This was called Jim Crowism. As a matter of fact, in 1909, there was a strange riot that took place because they did not want black people to live in a certain location in the North. And because they didn't want them to live where they wanted to live in the North, this meant that black people were being segregated. So Jim Crowism brought on segregation. I hear somebody calling my daughter who's been working on a computer, trying to get it to work for me, and she's been working on it for some time, and nothing has occurred. Well, let's take a little break right here from the conversation that I'm having with you concerning the historical events of Jim Crowism as I saw it as a child, and talk about Paul Willis and his genius, his ability to write music, compose, arrange, and write music. A CD that he put out a long time ago. He had all kinds of musicians to come in and to put the music together. And it was a remarkable undertaking, but it was one of these situations where he financially did not have the wherewithal to be able to pay all these musicians over a strong period of time. So he had to put together one band after the next band to actually accomplish the task. On the album, he has a certain number of songs I can't remember right offhand, and all of the information that I wanted to tell you about is on my computer, and of course my computer is playing games with me, as it normally does. So, but if you have an opportunity, I will, on my next time talking to you on the radio, tell you precisely about how you can get in touch with Mr. Willis so you can purchase that CD, because yours truly is on that. I'm one of the singers on that, and the song was written for me specifically. It was earmarked to talk about Paul Willis and his wife, what he was thinking about in terms of his wife at that particular time. Most of All is the name of the song. And it's probably one of the better things that he did. Although, I'm going to tell you a story that happened, and you might find this extremely interesting. We were in a recording studio, and in that recording studio, he had imported some really fantastic musicians. A friend of mine who played all kinds of music, actually from Waterbury, Connecticut, but this was up in Windsor. And we went through the process of writing the music and then having the musicians perform it. And he imported a guy from Yale University to play the guitar, and another guy to play saxophone from somewhere else in Connecticut. And we started recording my song. After we finished my recording and laid the tracks for that, we went on to another song. And other musicians got in and they started playing. And they really started playing it very, very well. And what happened was that it just actually did an extremely well process. And we thought it was still recording. And the people who were in charge of the recording had cut off the doggone thing. These guys were jamming. I mean, they really took it to another level. We thought we had recorded all that. That was going to be almost like the sermon that was done by Jimmy Smith, and it went on and on and on, and they really were gigging. Both Paul and I were really cracking up, and after it was all over, we said to the people who were recording it, "Did you get all that?" They looked at us and said, "Oh, no, we cut it off a while ago." So bad. But that would have been a bestseller. Listen, my daughter has the opportunity to get me to this part. The password is coffee 1 2. Yeah. Yes. So she's got me back to coffee 1 2. You need to put your capital letter C. So let's see what happens. Just a minute, hold on. Let me get over here. Because I can do this part. I don't know how much of this we're going to be able to give you, but let's see if I can get through to this right here. Okay, we're like for you to listen to this. This is about Jim Crowism. Have an opportunity to listen.
This mob of over 100 people marched on an African-American house in October of 1909 to try to stop this family from moving in. The leading men of Minneapolis, as the newspaper called them, these are not the kind of people who want to be involved in mob violence. And they don't have to, because they have other tools that they can use. And there's this tool that they become aware of. It's called a racial covenant. And so just a few months after the confrontation, we see the first racial covenant appear in the Minneapolis property. And this is where you first see this racial language.
Caucasians only, Aryans only, no Negroes or no members of African blood or descent.
100% of them were aimed at black people.
In many ways, racial covenants, this is kind of ground zero of residential segregation. In the United States, and racism has a very, very long history, but this particular deployment of racism is fairly new, and this idea was really made material through instruments like racial covenants.
The law of the street, the law of the courts working in consort to discourage blacks from moving into white neighborhoods.
It starts out as private property developers, but eventually you have the federal government encouraging these racial covenants, demanding actually that any investment they make is protected with this kind of racial exclusivity. You can covenant entire areas of the city. It makes it off limits. That's pretty powerful. This is Jim Crow of the North.
Experience. TPT is committed to telling the full range of our state's past, including the difficult history. The Mapping Prejudice Project at the University of Minnesota has documented the widespread use of race-based restrictions buried in the deeds of homes in Hennepin County. The research offers some answers as to why Minnesota has some of the worst racial disparities in the nation. Our new documentary explores this history, which amounts to what some researchers describe as a hidden system of Jim Crow of the North.
By the end of the century, it would seem that Minnesota was one of the most enlightened states with regard to race. You had a leadership of the state that seemed much more amenable to doing the right thing, or at least supporting in word policies that respected the dignity of the African American. Frank Wheaton came from Maryland. Wheaton came to Minnesota. He saw opportunity out here. He already had a law degree when he entered the law school at the university. And when he got out, he had aspirations for political advancement. He understood how to establish a rapport with the party apparatus. And as a result of their support, he was able to win an election in South Minneapolis with a constituency made up of white and immigrant voters. He authored two bits of legislation that dealt with civil rights, public accommodations. The civil rights bill, the accommodations bill, only dealt with blacks not being discriminated against in terms of going to restaurants, hotels, riding in streetcars, the railroads, places like that. It didn't really deal with other issues like schools and housing and things of that nature. But for all intents and purposes, it was a major step forward with regard to civil rights.
1910, Minneapolis isn't particularly segregated. There is emerging African-American neighborhoods around Lake Harriet, around West River Road, certainly on the east side of Minneapolis. Prospect Park is this beautiful neighborhood, very close to downtown, very close to the University of Minnesota, right on the banks of the Mississippi River. It was a very desirable neighborhood, and I think neighbors weren't surprised when they saw a house that fit into this neighborhood on what is now East Franklin Avenue. Madison Jackson, he was a guy who had a law degree, but he was a Pullman porter. He moved his family to Prospect Park, and he built a house there. This was the first black family there.
My father had bought a piece of land in what is known as Prospect Park, Minneapolis, and he broke ground and built the house in which I grew up. Until the house was nearly completed, the completely white community did not realize that a black family was moving in. And when we moved in, the whole community became quite aroused that a black family should be moving in.
Marvel Jackson, she said, when the neighbors across the street saw who they were, she said that lady started screaming when she realized that it was an African-American family that was moving in across the street from her.
I was seven, so I remember them. Meetings on our lawn as to why we could not live there. When my father and mother wouldn't budge, they had committees come to meet them. And I remember sitting on the steps listening to some of the things that were said. For instance, one of the things, our children will not play with your children. And my father hadn't thought about the impact on the children. My father built us a playground, like there was no other like it in the whole area. And we became the most popular children in the place. The neighbors couldn't keep their children away.
A little while after they moved in, the father's friend and coworker also wanted to build a house in the neighborhood.
William and Daisy Simpson, they were going to build a house as well. And they were staying in the Jackson house while their house was under construction. And I think that was the tipping point.
And that's when the resistance from white homeowners really ramped up.
And this is where the Tribune reports a race war in Prospect Park. This mob of over 100 people, the newspaper described it as some of the most powerful people in Minneapolis, marched on the Jackson House in October of 1909. They read prepared statements.
It was decided that a large delegation should call upon you to make doubly impressive a fact, namely, that the white residents of this district do not want members of your race domiciled in our midst. We're not here to argue, but to make a perfectly plain statement of our position in the matter, to wit, that we do not want you.
And as men of prudence, judgment, and determination, we will do everything we can to prevent this. And then there was another threat.
Rumors have been brought to our attention that there are parties in this vicinity who are determined that you and those of your race shall not reside in this district, that they have firmly declared themselves ready to take any steps necessary to bring about your removal.
And you have to understand, in 1909, this is a period where lynchings are commonplace. These were not idle threats. The amazing thing to me is that both of these families persisted. They stayed in their houses. The Simpsons built a lovely home, which is still there today. Marvel blazed a trail. She was the first African-American child to go through Pratt Elementary School. I learned that her mother had actually dated W.E.B. Du Bois before marrying Madison Jackson. That gives me clues as to what that household must have been like. As soon as they became teenagers, all those white friends she had basically abandoned her.
At that time, I determined I was going to get out of that kind of society and go where my people were.
She went to the University of Minnesota, where she dated Roy Wilkins and was engaged to him briefly. As soon as she finished at the University of Minnesota, she got out of Minneapolis. Her parents had protected her, I think, from a lot of the racism in her childhood, but when you get to be a grown-up, you certainly can experience this more. And she realized there was really no place for her here. Well, Minneapolis' loss with the Harlem Renaissance gave. She ended up moving to New York City. She ended up working for W.E.B. Du Bois. She ended up becoming one of the premier African-American journalists in the country. And then she became one of the first Black journalists to work for an all-white publication. So she has this incredible career, incredible talents, gifts, passion, and Minneapolis lost her. Madison Jackson died in 1927. Once he died and they sold the house, both families left Minneapolis. And I just wonder what it would have been like, you know, if they had been welcomed. You know, Prospect Park had become an enclave for Black intellectuals and Black civil rights activists. What would that have been like? How would the city be different? And that's what I think about a lot when I think about this story. The problem with the Madison Jackson and William Simpson incident is people had to show up in their front yard and threaten them. And this was in 1909. I don't think it's any coincidence that in May of 1910, the First Racial Covenant shows up in South Minneapolis. I'm pretty sure I know who wrote that covenant, and that was one Edmund G. Walton. He was a real estate developer. The legacy he left on Minneapolis, I mean, there's Edmund Boulevard, there's all these additions with his last name. Really, probably the most important and reversed was this legacy of racial covenants. So when people purchase a home, traditionally you get an abstract package. And it shows every time your property, the property that you've just purchased, changed hands. And in Minneapolis, properties that were platted after 1910 are very likely to have these racial restrictions embedded in the property deed. Covenants can be building covenants. They can be setback requirements. But the racial covenants that we're concerned with tells you who can or cannot live, lease, even occupy certain spaces.
Racially restrictive covenants, private contracts between individuals that allow them to dictate to whom they'll sell their property.
Identifying racial covenants, however, has proved remarkably challenging. The only way to find racial covenants are to read warranty deeds. We're looking at about 3 million deeds in Hennepin County between 1900 and 1960, and each deed on average runs about 3 pages. So we're in the ballpark of 10 million or so pages of text. Penny found about 4,000, 5,000 racial covenants by herself, the old-fashioned way. She just went down to the county recorder's office and started going through deeds. And she found several thousand racially restrictive covenants, and that was enough to get us thinking, okay, hey, you know, maybe we can do more than just show that racial covenants were a practice that was used in Minneapolis. What if we can map all of them? The first map that Penny made was shocking. I was shocked when I saw this, and I was shocked when she started reading me some of the language of these racial covenants.
The wording can be very different. They're working on early 20th century ideas of race. Chinese, Japanese, Negro, Moorish, Turkish, Mongolian, Hebrew, sometimes Semitic, people of African blood or descent. No Negroes or Jews. only Caucasians except for their domestic servants of a different race who might be domiciled with the owner.
Many of them were written during the period where eugenics is at front and center of American scientific thought, and that language is often what you see in these deeds.
Only people of the Aryan race can inhabit this land.
Or the Aryan branch of the Caucasian race.
I think one of the surprising things that I found in this research is 100% of these covenants are aimed at African Americans.
There's that. That's black. Okay, here's the legal description.
What we're doing with Mapping Prejudice is we're using digital tools to do a lot of the heavy lifting to help us identify the deeds that do contain racially restrictive covenants.
Covenants exist across the country. People say, well, why aren't you doing this for St. Paul, too? I know there are covenants in St. Paul. Their deeds are not scanned.
Which is incredibly unwieldy, right? For traditional research methods where you go down to the archive and you just start going through the material, you need an army of undergrads and the better part of a century, and even then I'm not convinced you'd be able to get through all of them. So we use OCR to translate these digitized warranty deeds into searchable text documents. Once we have these in text document form, I can write a script that iterates through and looks for predefined racial terms. And whenever it finds a match, we flag this corresponding deed image. And once we have this into the still very large but manageable realm of, you know, around 40,000 flagged images, we have volunteers to help us transcribe them.
And it says, may not be sold, mortgaged, or leased to or occupied by any person or persons other than members of the Caucasian race. Yep. Okay.
And those answers I then export, and this actually gives me enough data to build the map.
Hey, are you awake? I know how hard it can be. Sometimes just getting out of bed is a hassle. You feel tired, fatigued, a little lethargic.
Planning has always been intentional. Space has always been intentionally manufactured to shape and represent values. The question is whose values and for whom benefit? And are you historically low-income folks of color in particular, and, you know, larger racial and ethnic groups more broadly, have not been at the center of the benefits of urban planning.
The covenants were first put in 1910, but at that point, developers could start buying up large sections of farmland that had joined the city.
When a developer buys what used to be a farm on the outskirts of town, they buy it, divide it into six city lots, and sell the individual lots off. At that point, when they start selling off the individual lots, that's really when their racial covenants can be injected into the property record.
So people like Samuel Phillips, Thorpe Brothers, could buy this up and just plat it and lay it out as they saw fit and put in covenants. It was a very efficient way of doing this. There's this real estate convention. It's there that J.C. Nichols, who runs the Country Club Estate in Kansas City, gets up and said, a few years ago, I was really hesitant, but now I can't sell a property without them. And Sam Thorpe was certainly there. He was a retired president. He comes back in August of 1912, buys up the land that will become Thorpe Brothers Nokomis Paris. And that is the first fully covenanted edition that I know of. It talks about no colored people or other objectionable types. Mary Clear was a woman who inherited many of the Dorman Edition property near Restorer Road. After 1910, she started putting in racial covenants. It will never be sold or transferred or leased or conveyed to anyone who's a Negro. And that goes for people who are living with Negroes or married to Negroes. She adopted that early on. Her first one shows up about 1911 or 12. And you see this all through the teens and 20s with her. And Edmund Walton did the same thing along West River Road. At one point, I think they said he had bought up 437 acres along the river. He had gone in 1910 from sort of surreptitiously putting these covenants in, not recording them. Less than a decade later, he was bragging about them in the newspaper. There was an ad, and he printed the covenant, which shows you how quickly they were accepted.
The Supreme Court even held that restrictive covenants were constitutional. This was in the case of Corrigan v. Buckley, and it was in that decision where the court resolved that restrictive covenants are contracts, and as such, they are lawful. Now, forget about the fact that they discriminate, and forget about the fact that once we say these contracts exist, we are bringing up a violation issue of the 14th Amendment. Forget about that. The key thing is that the Supreme Court validated segregation, validated discrimination.
You have the full force of the law, the court system, determining who could go where.
And what will happen as a result of that is you'll see efforts to ensure that a denial to one of the most basic foundations of opportunity for African Americans will be codified in the United States as a result.
You had not only the courts supporting it, but also a kind of license of sorts of people going to the streets and harassing blacks who moved into white neighborhoods. The white neighbors, knowing that Bill Francis couple was moving in, offered them money to not move into the house. William Francis and his wife Nellie, who is one of my heroes, rejected that and moved in, and as a result faced all kinds of harassment. The Francis family did not live there for very long, because shortly after moving in, William T. Francis was appointed to be the consul to Liberia, in effect an ambassador, and so they moved to Africa. It's an example of how even the most prominent of African Americans in Minnesota at the time, who had established contacts with some of the most powerful people in American politics, Nellie herself had personal audiences with Andrew Carnegie and three U.S. presidents, that despite their successes and their influence, could still be exposed to racial animus. So it shows the intensity of property values, perception of property values and race.
So what racial covenants did is they hardened boundaries. They hardened these invisible racial boundaries.
It's interesting because even in neighborhoods where there maybe aren't any covenants, just being in proximity to covenants is really powerful for keeping that neighborhood white still.
Homes are often taken for granted for some of us. Instances like the Lee family faced makes us realize that a home is a kind of fragile thing. It's a one-and-a-half-story, quite modest bungalow. You wouldn't particularly notice it, but when you know anything about its history and the story of the Lee family, it becomes quite powerful.
Arthur Lee was a World War I vet. He worked at the post office. He had a good, steady paycheck at a time when 30% of the city is out of work. So he finds this house that someone is willing to sell him on 46th and Columbus. It was not covenanted. They had the temerity to violate what is at that point this boundary in the urban landscape. So Arthur Lee, he moves into the house. Now, first, the neighborhood association gets together, and they try to buy him out. They contact the bank. They contact different lawyers. They try legal means. In July of 1931, by newspaper reports, 5,000 or 6,000 white people at any given time are milling around his house, trying to drive him out.
Black paint was thrown on their house.
Their dog is poisoned. Vandalism, intimidation. The family has to sleep in the basement. They had the sense that they had set these boundaries, that no one was to violate them. This is just another tool, so to speak, this citizen terrorism. And in this particular case, Papa, who is a World War I vet, right, comes home to believe that his service to our country gave him the same access as his white counterpart, but learned very quickly that that was not the case. It's really important for families like the Lee family to have advocates to help them fight. Being able to have lawyers like Lena Olive Smith and being able to have the NAACP on their side was really powerful in making sure that their voices were heard. The NAACP was definitely fighting against these racial covenants and these instances of racial housing discrimination. There's also smaller clubs and organizations that were really focused on fighting this. Unfortunately, even with all of these legal protections and organizations fighting for them, a lot of people don't end up getting the end result they want. Edith and Arthur Lee and their daughter Mary, they stayed for 2 years. They didn't make it longer than 2 years. I think the pressure was just too great for them. I can only imagine, as a parent, as someone who wants to ensure that I'm living my values, like what it would mean to put my family at risk, what it would mean to always feel like I'm looking over my shoulder just to protect my rights. And you have this escalation of this sense of threat thanks to racial covenants. So it's that intensification, that normalization of these racist ideas that leads to the Lee House.
The marker at the corner of the property has a depiction, an image of Arthur Lee. For those who just walk by, I think it gets them thinking about it.
Home ownership is the basis of a happy, contented family life. And now, through the use of a National Housing Act insured mortgage, is brought within the reach of all citizens on a monthly payment.
And this is the New Deal when the FDR administration is looking for ways to try to stabilize the housing market. The Fair Housing Act is passed in 1934. And as part of that, the Homeowners Loan Corporation is also established with the hope that if you could establish long-term mortgages with fixed interest rates, you could create pathways to homeownership for most Americans.
This time, they can buy this house with monthly payments that are less than they now spend for rent.
When the FHA starts underwriting mortgages in the 1930s, this really is a game changer in a lot of ways. It takes a lot of risk off the banks, it places it onto the federal government, and now working class, middle class families, they're able to purchase a home.
Unfortunately, as part of that, what the HOLC does is it establishes designations for neighborhoods based on the occupants of those neighborhoods.
And this is where the term redlining comes into place. The FHA, they made color-coded maps of all the largest cities in the United States, and they broke cities down into four different areas. Red is considered hazardous. That's the worst. Yellow is considered definitely declining. Blue is considered still desirable. And green is considered the best.
And what's so powerful about this kind of scale of measuring investment, it was about value to people.
The fact of the matter is that there was no evidence that those people who lived in those communities, predominantly black and brown people and foreign-born people, would have defaulted on loans.
there are no firm realities behind the close proximity to blackness in your property values going down. That's just not true.
The FHA is being very upfront and very explicit in how they're linking spatial desirability with racial occupancy. It's this racialization space idea. So areas that were predominantly African-American or majority minority are really, in a lot of cases, even if there's a few non-white people there, that's often enough to be redlined. So when they built these maps, they also explained why each area got the ranking it did.
The area around 4th Avenue South, which is called Old South High, this was a nice area. It had nice homes. It's the historic African-American neighborhood on the south side of Minneapolis.
This one part of South Minneapolis was redlined specifically due to, and I'm quoting, a gradual infiltration of Negroes and Asiatics. The FHA refused to give an area a green-lined designation. Again, this is the best designation that they'll offer unless, and I'm quoting again, restrictive covenants are already in place. That lies from the FHA underwriting manual. Racial covenants aren't just about discriminating against people of color. It's about enriching white people. And I think that's the part that often gets lost in this narrative. And I think it does speak to the ways that white supremacy have been embedded and really built structures and built environments. I mean, if you're grandparents bought a home on Minnehaha Creek, you know, that home's worth, what, $500,000? If your grandparents rented an area that was redlined and then subsequently destroyed by a freeway project, you know, you're not inheriting anything.
In a lot of ways, the practice of redlining, which didn't start until the 1930s, institutionalized and spread racial covenants all over the country because suddenly developers got sanctioned, they got direction from the federal government saying, this is best practices if you want to have a really high rating from us, if you want to get the most favorable terms for any loans.
By kind of deintegrating Minneapolis, which in many ways is what racial covenants are doing, this set the stage and enabled all these subsequent systems of inequality to really take hold.
It's a very persistent myth that northern cities never had formal segregation. The South had Jim Crow, and look at those signs. Well, racial covenants did the work of Jim Crow in the North, all over the North.
Many, many whites simply were not aware that there was a segregation. So many people in Minneapolis being outraged when they thought that their friend was being discriminated against. They knew something was happening, but it wasn't happening to your friend. That was what kind of this mixed kind of a situation that we had in Minneapolis. I mean, when you can imagine these people, their parents sent me cookies and, you know, cakes all during the war. And I was welcome in their house. There was no question about it. And then there's other people who were just absolutely Klansmen. You know, that was what Minneapolis was all about.
But that was that was my generation in Minneapolis. We were hemmed in that ghetto. And that was our life. That was our world.
The 1935 land use planning map used to define which place would get mortgages versus others circled these areas, called them slums, places where quote-unquote Negroes lived. These are places to avoid, right? So they're going to give you substandard housing, and they're going to contain you. Access to affordable housing was a challenge. When you think about the reasons behind the creation of public housing, we had a lot of folks forced to the low-wage sector, right? And you're thinking about what jobs or opportunities that low-income folks of color even had access to at this time. You know, I would argue that with the creation of public housing in 1938, the Sumner-Phillips homes began this really interesting iteration of the redesign of space. You have 400 units of public housing which were segregated at the time created. In 1953, the City Council of Minneapolis refused to scatter another 1,000 units of public housing outside of the Sumner-Phillips homes area. And where did these pressures come from? You had both internal conservative politicians and outlying suburban communities coming in saying, not in my neighborhood. And the city council crumbled under the pressure. and then took what was 400 units of public housing to over 1,000 units in less than a decade. They have strategically manufactured urban poverty. This history is very personal for me. I'm a third-generation Minneapolitan. My grandparents were immigrants from Sweden who came to this country with nothing, you know, worked incredibly hard jobs. But both sets of my grandparents in 1942 were able to buy houses in South Minneapolis. These houses were in a part of the city that was blanketed by racial covenants. Because of those racial covenants, my parents grew up in neighborhoods that were entirely white. And in many ways, they described them as a paradise for children. They had wonderful parks. They had really solid schools that sent them to college. But no one in their neighborhood ever talked about the fact that this neighborhood was only for white people. And I want everyone with this map to imagine themselves in this landscape of privilege and disenfranchisement.
The Justice Department contended that restrictive covenants among private citizens bar Negroes and other minority groups from residential areas and are not enforceable by the courts. Their joint brief described the covenants as an artificial quarantine of minority groups. Covenants were one of the big issues that the NAACP was tackling in the first half of the 20th century.
Thurgood Marshall was leader of the litigation part of the NAACP. When Thurgood was asked upon his retirement what was the most important case, everyone assumed he would say Brown versus Board of Education. He said, no, it was Shelley v. Kramer.
Shelley v. Kramer in the late 1940s was one of the more seminal civil rights cases that ever made it to the Supreme Court. It didn't explicitly end racial covenants as a practice, but it was a pretty big blow.
There could be no enforcement of restrictive covenants. So you could still write a restrictive covenant, but a person who signed it could breach the contract and sell it to a black person, and they would not be held liable.
It wasn't as effective as a lot of folks hoped. What people started doing is instead of suing for breach of contract, they would sue for damages. So if somebody sells a covenant at home to an African American, the neighbors can sue that person because their property values are now lower.
Well, is there anything the matter?
There's never going to be any violence in this part of town. We're peaceful people. You've got friends here. I'm your friend. We just want to know what it is you think you're doing to us.
If I have a covenant at home and I sell it to somebody who isn't white and I get sued, I lose the house. Any equity I've accumulated, the property reverts to the initial granting party, so whoever first put that covenant on the land. If that person's dead, I would revert to that, the heirs or assigns of the initial covenanting party. So the risk of going against these things is just like astronomical.
The restrictive covenants has already laid the foundation for continued denial of equality for African Americans by virtue of these private contracts, which the Supreme Court will determine in 1948 are judicially unenforceable, but still legal. In fact, it plays out in a very powerful way in Lorraine Hansberry's play, A Raisin in the Sun.
You know that money we got in the mail this morning?
Yes, sir.
But what do you think your grandmama done with that?
I don't know, Grandma.
She went and she bought you a house.
As that play was being produced, you have situations across the country, including one in Delaware, where my family in Collins Park are forced out of their home by a mob, and then ultimately the home is bombed. But what Lorraine Hansberry captures in there, in that wonderful passage where Walter Younger is kind of laying out what the foundations for freedom and equality will be for his family, and it's homeownership. One day, son, we're going to sit down and we're going to see all the great schools in America. But the pathway to that is the ownership of a home. And Lorraine Hansberry hit on something very powerful in A Raisin in the Sun, because it's playing out about this family seeking home ownership as a pathway to true freedom and true equality.
And there is no one factor more representative of or more conducive to the economic well-being of the American citizen than the home in which he lives.
Thank you.
spread of covenants in the first half of the 20th century is pretty much the same story as the spread of the Twin Cities over the first half of the 20th century. The first ring suburbs, Edina, St. Louis Park, Bridgefield, Bloomington, are all blanketed in racial covenants. They probably have a higher density of restrictions than Minneapolis does, simply because there was more development happening in Bloomington around 1950 than in Minneapolis. And the effects of that are very surprising, right? Like, that ring is very white, and this pushes African Americans into kind of the center of Minneapolis.
It denies them access to those mortgages. It denies them the opportunity to sell their homes. And in that sense, it closes off an opportunity to escape those communities, but more importantly, denies them the same pathway to the acquisition of wealth, home ownership, and then, of course, the sale of those properties and bequeathing those properties to their children.
My dad made a Tilson would have open houses on, I think it was on 41st and 4th, was the model home. It was something to behold because for the kids, you don't really understand what this desegregation meant or what segregation really meant and redlining. You didn't really know, but you saw people come in who knew what that meant.
And in fact, I think the spokesman billed the Tilson Bill homes as possibly the first open housing event in the nation. So it was one of the first times African Americans could buy new homes on the quote-unquote open market.
I know.
It's a huge piece of housing history for the construction of for the Tilson built homes that your dad demanded that there be African American men working on those jobs.
He knew what that economic power could be, what those job power could be. And he did insist on his contractors bringing people of color to the job. And it was extremely, extremely important to him. And I think the fact that it started here, again, is something unique about Minnesota.
At the same time, the disparities that we have now don't support that it was continuing.
No, it didn't carry out throughout the whole community, that's for sure, the city, yeah.
Right.
It wasn't citywide. And so there is some significant divide that still lasts.
I'm going to have to stop there, and hopefully you had an opportunity to hear what happened in Minnesota. And I chose this particular presentation because of the killing that has taken place in Minnesota. And what I thought you might have a better understanding of why the policeman felt he could do what he did, because this has been going on for a long time in the north as well as in the south, and Minnesota happens to be in the northern part of the western part of the United States. It's too bad that other cities could not do a study of what happened in their particular cities as it relates to Jim Crowism, because every city had some Jim Crowism, whether it was in the north, whether it was in the south, whether it was in the west, or whether it was in the east. There was some form of Jim Crowism. You often think that women experienced much of what black people did back in the day, back in the 1920s and 30s. But they were unable to vote either, but they still took the side and sided with their husbands on supporting a separation of what was going on, a separation and an unequal kind of treatment, both in housing as well as in education. And later on, they forced to, even though going back to as far as Frederick Douglass, who was a part of the women's rights movements back in the 1800s, to try to help women get a hold on their freedoms in terms of part of the democracy. And same thing that happened not only then, but is happening now, where women have taken another level and have just turned their backs on what is happening. Some of them have, and then some of them are joining in now because of the death. This has been a very extremely interesting presentation, primarily because part of it was done before I could actually, I had to talk about it before I was able to get the program on my computer. This has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean, and sorry, but they have to bring this to a conclusion. But once again, on Friday, we will start again at 4:30, and I'll be able to give you all the information concerning Paul Willis on how you can get in touch with him for the three different things. He's put together a calling book, and I'll have to talk to you about that also. So until then, have a great week, people, and wear your mask. Thank you.